it is imperative that the members of this body send a message to those with pregnancies about the value of the unborn.
The Senate passes a bill defining medically necessary abortions. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 9th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Air Force cuts all flying hours for the F-16 squadron at Eielson Air Force Base.
They've been reassigned by the Air Force to units that are preparing to deploy and need those flying hours more than we would.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Right now, the state of Alaska is obligated to provide Medicaid funding for all medically necessary abortions. Today, the Senate passed a bill that would narrow that definition. It's the first time the Senate has passed an abortion bill since 2006. The legislation would only allow for Medicaid payments if a woman is at serious risk of physical harm if she goes through with her pregnancy, or if the woman is a victim of rape or incest. It specifically excludes mental health conditions. Supporters of the legislation have characterized that as a loophole through which women can get Medicaid coverage for elective procedures. Anti-abortion groups have gotten behind the bill, saying it would reduce the number of abortions in the state because low-income women are less likely to go through with the procedure if they can't secure payment. Senator John Coghill, a North Pole Republican, sponsored the bill, and he says that his intent was narrower than that.
This debate is not about limiting anything. It was really about defining who pays for what. So they hope it limits. I tend to agree with them, but that's not the debate.
Opponents of the bill say the measure chips away at reproductive rights and that it's unfair to poor women. Democrats in the minority also questioned its constitutionality and suggested it could open up the state to a number of legal problems. Anchorage Democrat Bill Willikowski noted that crime victims couldn't use the vagueness of a mental health exception to get Medicaid to cover an abortion.
We're statutorily forcing women to disclose rape and incest. And what that does is, we heard about this in Senate Judiciary, it puts physicians in an extremely difficult position, and it puts potentially the state of Alaska in an extremely difficult position.
One amendment was made to the bill. Senator Berta Gardner, an Anchorage Democrat, offered a change that would expand the state's Medicaid program to offer more family planning and women's health services, with the idea being to reduce the number of unplanned pregnancies. The bill's sponsor removed his objection after Liesl McGuire and Anna Faircloth, two moderate Republican women from Anchorage, voiced their support for the change. McGuire described it as a pro-life and pro-woman compromise.
It is imperative that the members of this body send a message to those with pregnancies about the value of the unborn, but also the value of their life.
The bill passed 14-6, mostly on caucus lines. Sitka Republican Bert Stedman and Juneau Democrat Dennis Egan both broke with the majority to oppose the bill, while Bethel Democrat Lyman Hoffman voted for it. A companion bill is currently moving through the House with just one committee left to review it. The future of the Kinnickarm Bridge project is now in question. A bill advancing the project was pulled from floor consideration last night, and now a member of the House majority is pushing for a change that would take away the Kinnickarm Bridge and toll authorities' independence. Anchorage Republican Mia Costello's amendment would fold Kibata into the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, a state agency that's shepherded projects like an in-state gas line in their early stages of development. Representative Mark Newman, a Big Lake Republican who sponsored the bill, opposes the change. He told the Rules Committee this morning that it could kill the project. The bill is being held until legislators can get more information on the legal ramifications of the move. Uncertainty over the project comes after state auditors released a report Friday concluding that revenue projections for the bridge were unreasonably optimistic and could open up the state to financial risk. The Air Force has grounded the 18th Aggressor Squadron at Eielson Air Force Base due to federal budget restrictions. The squadron of F-16s is the same one the Air Force has considered relocating to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson near Anchorage. But the Air Force says the groundings have nothing to do with the potential relocation. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
According to the Air Force, the F-16s will stand down for the remainder of this fiscal year, which ends September 30th. Captain Yost Verdine is the chief for public affairs for the 354th Fighter Wing at Eielson Air Force Base. He says federal budget cuts eliminated over 40,000 flying hours across the nation.
Flying hours that were originally assigned to the 354th Fighter Wing have been cut, and they've been reassigned by the Air Force to units that are preparing to deploy and need those flying hours more than we would.
The 18th Aggressor Squadron is a training squadron. No jobs will be lost from the groundings, and Verdine says the economic impact will be minimal.
During a directed stand-down, the pilots will generally use flight simulators. They'll conduct academic training. Basically, they'll do a lot of different things to make sure they're ready to fly again when it is time to. As a part of it, maintenance on the aircraft, it just doesn't stop. You can't just let them sit, same way you can't let your car sit and expect it to turn over 6 months later.
Because the F-16s won't be flying, support operations for a squadron of F-22s based at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson outside of Anchorage will also end. The Air Force is currently working on an environmental impact statement that's related to the military's plan to relocate the 18th Aggressor Squadron to J-Bear. But Verdine says the grounding is unrelated.
They are two separate actions. One doesn't have much of an effect on the other, because you could look at a lot of bases who have stuff being grounded as well. It's not only us being standing down flying.
The announcement comes a week after the Air Force canceled Northern Edge and Red Flag training exercises, both based at Eielson. Both exercises draw thousands of military personnel from outside the state and the nation. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Oregon investigators are looking into the case of a Juneau High School football assistant coach who allegedly knocked out a student during a sparring match last summer. Juneau Police Sergeant Chris Burke says the Juneau School District notified them about the incident on Friday.
We have seen the video, so we're assisting the agency in Oregon that will be the lead investigators on it. We're still working with jurisdictional things right now, but because most of the people that were involved in it are here in Juneau, we'll be assisting them with interviews and things like that.
Oregon authorities will likely decide whether to press charges when the investigation wraps up. The incident during the team's trip last summer to a football camp in Gold Beach, Oregon, was apparently captured on video and briefly posted on YouTube. The video is not publicly available. It reportedly shows John Wall, an assistant coach for the Thunder Mountain High School football team, engaging in a boxing match with an incoming freshman player. Both were reportedly wearing gloves. Wall allegedly sucker punches the boy, and the boy collapses unconscious as the coach celebrates. Wall also works as a teacher at a Juneau middle school. Juneau School Superintendent Glenn Gelbrick has not returned calls for comment, but in an earlier email, he stated that two coaches were placed on administrative leave pending outcome of the investigation. He did not name the coaches. Gelbrick says they turned the matter over to the Juneau Police Department, filed a report with the state's Office of Children's Services, and are cooperating with the investigation. Gelbrick also says that he's concerned about emerging details of the allegations and that it went unreported for nearly 9 months. Efforts to contact the father of the boy and John Wall were not immediately successful. Other coaches with the Thunder Mountain High School football team have not returned calls seeking comment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 4,000-mile journey from the Pacific Northwest to the Arctic.
We were dealing with mosquitoes worse than anything we've ever seen, and a horrible headwind coming off the Arctic Ocean.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage of state government since 1991. On the web at akbudgetreport.com.
President Barack Obama's nominee to head the Energy Department, director of the MIT Energy Initiative, Ernest Moniz, testified before the Senate Energy Committee today. That's the first step before his confirmation goes to the full Senate. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, Dr. Moniz remains cagey on his thoughts of exporting natural gas.
Dr. Moniz is a respected physicist who has spent years working at the intersection of policy and scientific research. Before returning to MIT in 2001, Dr. Moniz spent 4 years as undersecretary at the Energy Department, so he's had practice artfully dodging questions and providing diplomatic, often vague answers. Both the committee chairman, Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, and the panel's top Republican, Senator Lisa Murkowski, used their first comments to pin the nominee down on exporting liquefied natural gas. Senator Murkowski asked him whether he supports exports of LNG, and Dr. Moniz responded.
I believe the Natural Gas Act suggests that one should move forward with licenses unless there is a clear public interest issue.
Dr. Moniz went on to say that cumulative effects, including overall cost, need to be examined before the Energy Department would grant an export license.
But fundamentally, I think all of these issues have to come together and make a transparent, analytically based evaluation, application by application.
A case-by-case approval process could be what export skeptics want to hear. Senator Wyden, a critic of exporting natural gas, says he's concerned what exports would do to prices at both the national and regional levels. Confirmation hearings provide senators a chance to rally a base and bring up parochial home state issues. Senator Joe Manchin, a conservative Democrat from increasingly Republican West Virginia, asked Dr. Moniz some pointed questions about threats to coal.
How much longer do you think taxpayers will have to subsidize renewables? Renewables until they're able to compete in the marketplace on their own?
Dr. Moniz dodged the question, offering up a long, winding answer. He says the role of the government in energy production
is to, first of all, make sure that the marketplace has options. Well, by marketplace, I mean all those who make different kinds of decisions, investors, companies, public servants, et cetera.
The Department of Energy is responsible for all sorts of programs, from a controversial loan program for energy firms to regulating fracking to assuring the safety of the country's nuclear weapons. The heavy load is something Senator Murkowski made note of.
You are not signing up for the easiest job here.
One thing the Energy Department is not responsible for is federal tax policy. But that's what Utah Senator Mike Lee, a Tea Party favorite, asked about. He wanted to know whether Dr. Moniz supports a carbon tax. Dr. Moniz responded in a fairly straightforward way. He's not the right person to ask.
First of all, I think it's important to say the administration has not proposed a carbon tax and has no plan to do so. I think that's the first point. The second point is Department of Energy is not the locus of discussions about such fiscal policies.
Dr. Moniz is expected to pass through both the committee and full Senate. Senator Wyden says he supports the nomination and he hopes to bring the nominee back for a vote sometime soon. Because, in Wyden's words, the sooner he's confirmed, the sooner he can get to work. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A recent D.C. court ruling has left state officials with a lot of legal uncertainty. The court said the Secretary of the Interior can take land into trust status for tribes in Alaska and cannot treat tribes here differently than in the lower 48. Michael Jarrity is the state's attorney general. He told APRN's Lori Townsend the decision was a disappointment that creates a big question mark.
We've already got, Native corporation land, state land, federal land, village corporations. We've got all kinds of things. And now we're going to have possibly trust land. And what that means or what that will mean in the real practical world, I don't know. I'm not sure the plaintiffs do either. But it's just it creates more of a patchwork of jurisdiction and authority. And I can't identify the biggest problem except it's the uncertainty associated with it.
Do you know if Native corporation lands the ANCs could transfer land to the tribes to be held in trust?
I don't know that. I think we would oppose that, but I honestly don't know that. I'm not sure that that's permissible. I know the Secretary of Interior can, or that's what the plaintiffs hope, but I don't know that the Native corporations can, honestly.
Does trust land status equate to Indian country with all of its attendant legal weight?
I don't believe so, but I suspect that the plaintiffs may contend that, but I don't believe it does. And I want to emphasize, this is a decision by a district court judge in Washington, D.C., who decided a legal question, and we're certainly not going to let matters rest here. So, but if you're asking me to accept it right now at face value, which until it's reversed and on appeal, I'm bound to do. I don't believe it should permit the creation of Indian country.
Can tribes create tribal law enforcement systems for trust lands?
Another that goes back to the big uncertainty, I think, that I alluded to earlier. I'm not sure. I don't know why they would want to take lands back into trust. I'm not sure what they intend to do with them once they have them. I'm not sure who would exercise authority over them. I believe the people on tribal lands are still citizens of Alaska and entitled to the same protections as an Alaska citizen, but would the state be able to enforce laws in those areas, arrest people, all those other tax in the land? I just don't know. That's, again, I think it goes to the uncertainty issue I raised earlier.
So at this point in time, it's difficult to know what sort of taxation implications this could have.
It is. For me, I honestly wouldn't venture a guess.
How will this trust status differ, if it's known, from the land that Metlakatla has in southeast Alaska, which is a reservation?
Well, I think that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that as I sit here, Lori. I think there probably are parallels between reservations and trust land. Obviously Metlakatla has had its status and had its reservation for many, many years. And so they have, I think they've worked through the wrinkles. I think we work closely with Metlakatla in terms of law enforcement and other issues. And I don't know that there's a big uncertainty associated with the state's relationship with Metlakatla. But in terms of whether that would be a model for other trust lands, should the secretary choose to convey lands in trust, I don't know. I guess part of the big question mark.
Attorney General Garrity, will the state appeal this decision?
Yes. We don't have a final decision right now, or final judgment, I should say, because the courts ask for additional briefing on this remedy issue, so the time for filing an appeal may not be ripe. There's a possibility of an interlocutory appeal, which would be, without waiting for final judgment. But those questions haven't been decided. But one way or the other, we will be filing an appeal.
Michael Garrity is the state attorney general. He says the case could eventually reach the United States Supreme Court.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Do you own a business or manage employees? Research shows that employees who feel supported at work with their parenting challenges are more loyal and productive. When you let employees know they can attend a teacher conference, stay at home with a sick child, or adjust their schedule to secure quality childcare, you contribute to stronger families. That's Strengthening Families Alaska Style. This message is sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust, THREAD, and Best Beginnings.
The Alaska Republican Party has ousted party chairwoman Debbie Brown, and state party vice chair Peter Goldberg has become the new chair. Goldberg's accession last night marks the latest chapter in the saga of the Republicans' messy internal politics. Brown says the action of the executive committee was illegal under party rules.
It's just a couple of factions that are basically at war within the Alaska Republican Party. It's very unfortunate that we cannot look for ways to have dialogue and conversation and move ahead in a respectable, honorable way with one another. But we've got a group of people who want to circumvent our party rules. They want to alter them to accomplish an end, which many, many Alaska Republicans are opposed to.
On January 31st, newly elected party chairman Russ Millette was ousted by the party's executive committee literally an hour before he was to take his seat. Vice Chair Brown was then named chairwoman in his place a day later. Millette and Brown were initially elected to party official seats in 2012 when a wave of presidential candidate Ron Paul supporters flooded the party's statewide meeting. Alaska Dispatch reported last night the Republican Executive Committee attempted to meet at party headquarters in Anchorage only to find themselves locked out of the building. Brown says she changed the locks, not an uncommon move for a new party leader.
In that there were a lot of keys that were out there. No one really knew who had the keys, who did not have the keys. And so I felt it was the responsible thing to do.
Brown is now headed for a Republican National Committee meeting in California. She says she hasn't decided if she will appeal her ouster.
I'm not certain that I will appeal it, but my biggest concern is that if I do appeal it, it will be an appeal to something that I believe was illegitimate in its origin.
Brown says she had terminated some party officials who had served under former Republican Party of Alaska Chairman Randy Redrick. Redrick did not return phone calls today. In January of this year, Anchorage Republicans transferred more than $34,000 in party funds to the Juneau chapter, essentially putting the cash out of reach of Millett and Brown. The Republican Central Committee, a larger committee of 90 or more members, meets again in late May in Homer. State Representative Bryce Edgman introduced a bill last week that would allow village public safety officers across the state to carry firearms. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
Since the program began in the 1970s, VPSOs have often been the only permanent law enforcement presence in many rural Alaskan communities, but they have never been able to carry guns. Representative Edgman's bill would change that.
I think it's time that we look at this issue very closely.
Edgman says allowing VPSOs to carry firearms will better equip them to serve and protect communities.
I think we're at a point now where we need to have the conversation about making sure our VPSOs are able to, number one, properly carry out their duties, but two, to also have the ability to protect themselves in instances where they're in harm's way.
Last month, a VPSO in Manicotic was fatally shot in the line of duty, stirring up debate across the state. The Association of Village Council Presidents runs the VPSO program in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. President Myron Nanning.
You know, why do we send our VPSOs to a situation that can result in death like this incident down in Manicotic and send them there without any firearms?
Nanning says out of the 27 VPSOs in the YK Delta, over half were in support of carrying firearms, though several others were undecided, Nanning says. Representative Edgman says the bill wouldn't just put guns in VPSOs' hands right out of the gate.
You know, nobody's suggesting that VPSOs be able to carry arms without getting the proper training. And we wrote that into the bill. That's sort of the part two of it all, is that we want our VPSOs to be properly trained as well.
Edgman says he has gotten bipartisan favor in Juneau.
Instantly, without really much effort, a lot of support that has cropped up here in the Capitol. And I think looking at my emails, there's been only anything but support from across the state. It's generated a lot of responses.
The bill will not be voted up or down this year as session is close to ending, Edgman says. There may be public hearings held this winter to discuss the issue. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
You can spend a lifetime exploring the terrain an Alaska couple traversed last year. KUAC's Dan Bross has more on the human-powered mega adventure.
Caroline Van Hemer and Patrick Farrell's 4,000-mile journey took them from the Pacific Northwest to the Arctic.
We rode the Inside Passage, skied over the Coast Mountains,
and then hiked and pack rafted up Yukon Territory along the Arctic coast and traversed the Brooks Range.
Van Hemert says the couple kept moving pretty much every day during their 2012 trek. The pair were already experienced mountaineers, skiers, and paddlers before heading out on their biggest adventure. Van Hemert says they chose rowing specialized boats Farrell built for the first phase of the trip.
They're similar to like an oversized kayak, but instead they have a movable rowing frame, and so we were actually able to use our legs for the entire journey, and that was a big benefit because as soon as we quit rowing, we were going to start skiing and then hiking, and we really needed to be able to move fairly quickly and not sort of have these atrophied legs.
The couple encountered rough seas, the first of many challenges of the trip, an experience Van Hemert says forces you to live differently.
Felt like really living in the present, and life was very simple.
Van Hemert relishes time spent in some of the most remote wilderness in North America, even if some of it was stressful, like a scary encounter with a predatory black bear in the Brooks Range.
We were kind of hiking through thick brush and had just come out into a more open area, and I heard a rustling in the bushes behind me and turned around, and there was a bear that was only about 15 feet behind, and was coming at me quite quickly, basically attempting to approach us and, from what we could tell, eat us.
Van Hemert says they used bear spray and hiking poles to fight off the persistent animal, which eventually wandered away. Another part of the adventure was less scary but more trying. Van Hemert describes traveling the Mackenzie River Delta as miserable.
We were dealing with mosquitoes worse than anything we've ever seen, and we've worked and lived up here for a long time. And a horrible headwind coming off the Arctic Ocean that was really challenging to paddle into with our little inflatable pack rafts. And it went on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Van Hemert says they started to question the broader vision of the trip, but worked to keep each other upbeat, adding that their relationship seems to thrive in the wilderness. Van Hemert and Farrell are sharing stories and images from their journey tonight in Fairbanks and in Anchorage April 16th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Matt Miller in Juneau, and Mark Earhart in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.